This
conference will.
I started reading this book about 2 weeks ago, and then I took it on the boat with me, and I can honestly tell you I didn't get a lot of pages read on the boat, but when I got back, I delved into it, and it's really exciting to me. But I, of course, love it. You have to understand I come from an economics and political science undergraduate degree, so it's right up my alley to read this kind of stuff, so I'm not sure it's going to be as exciting for all of you, but I can tell you I was exhilarated by the book. It just gave me a ton of information. The author is a fellow named Jim Clifton, and you can say, well, who is Jim Clifton? He's the chairman of Gallup. If you're familiar with the Gallup polls that are taken, this guy is the guy, okay? And what he did is he ran a Gallup poll worldwide, and they spent, millions of dollars figuring this out, using the scientists inside what to ask, what questions to ask, to get a temperament of the world. And they'd never done anything like this before. It's a brand new concept, and he just, it was far-reaching, of course. It went into, being able to interview, multimillionaires as well as the people on the desert, the Gobi Desert. And I mean, it was pretty amazing, the accumulation of data and what they did with siphoning that data. And that's kind of what the gist of the book is accumulated, all that accumulated data to find out, where our world is going, what direction we're going in, what are people thinking, what are people demanding, what are their interests, what's going. And I think Clifton did a great job of analyzing the data. I mean, I'm not in agreement with everything that he's concluded, but I found it fascinating what he's put in this book, because it just gave us a lot of insight into what's happening and what's going to happen in the next 100 years, 50 years in this world economy that we have. So, and he, of course, titled the book The Coming Jobs War, because he found in this Gallup poll that the majority of people are what? The majority of people are wanting a good job. That's the number one item that people talked about in all of his Gallup reviews, was having a good job. And if countries fail to create the good jobs, what's going to happen? Their societies will fail. And that's truer off the board. The leadership, I'll just read you a quote in the book, the leadership problem is that an increasing number of people in the world are miserable, hopeless, suffering, and becoming dangerously unhappy because they don't have an almighty good job, and in most cases, no hope of getting one. And when he defines, you hear the word good job throughout the book, and the word good job, what he means is that it's a job that has a paycheck from an employer and steady work that averages at least 30 hours per week. And the global labor economists tend to call these formal jobs versus informal jobs, which are part-time and day laborers and that kind of stuff. But this is what people are looking for, a good job. That's what they're looking for. So it's fascinating that he put this together, and he said, basically that in the next 30 years, in the past, the military might control this world. We had Russia, the Cold War crisis between Russia and the United States, and then Russia fell off, and the United States became the unquantifiable or unchallenged world leader, and that's dissipating now because of our own internal destruction. We've done it to ourselves, as we say. But the intriguing thing is that he's saying in the next 30 years, it's not going to be controlled by force and military might anymore. It's going to be instead controlled by an economic force as a result of GDP and jobs. And that's fascinating. The reason people are going after jobs today, he found that the world in the past, which wanted and desired love and money and food and shelter, today all they want is job. That's the number one directive. And this changes everything for leaders around the world, because now you make all your decisions based on the demand that's in your population. If the demand is for jobs, then all of your decisions about going to war, about everything else you're doing, always ties back to, will it create jobs? Is it something that's going to support a job market? So all those things, it changes the mechanism of how leaders make decisions. And in the future, wherever people take their talents, the most talented people, wherever they're attracted, that's going to become the number one job market, because the talent, that's where people are attracted to go. So in order for the United States to maintain its level of respect in the global economy, we're going to have to continue to attract the most talented people. And we haven't been great at doing that recently, and so we need to make some changes there as well. America still holds a special place, analyzed around the world, because we're the most powerful beacon of free enterprise in all of the world. So we have a very unique responsibility, and one of the results is that everyone will benefit from our success. That you cannot say that about other countries, but you can say that about America. World War II, if you looked at World War II, I love this analogy. If we would have lost World War II, think about how different the world would be today. It'd be, I don't know that we would define it as a quote-unquote free world today if we would have lost World War II. Well, Clifton is suggesting the current war on jobs is going to have a similar result. If we lose, China will win. So there's a connectiveness here that who's going to preempt us or take over that position if we fail in this jobs war. He also talked about the relationship between GDP and job growth. They are like chicken and the egg. They live together, one creates the other, and without one, the other one will die. So GDP and job growth are absolutely, they're almost like two in one as concepts. Currently, 30 million Americans are fighting this job war, and we have 30 million Americans out of work, and 18 million of them have totally lost hope, and they know that because they've even taken themselves off of the unemployment rolls, and they just have lost hope. They've stopped looking. They've dropped out of quote-unquote life, and joblessness in this arena breeds hopelessness. And if you look at the gross national well-being as a measurement, GNW, and he says we're going to hear a lot more of that in the next 10 to 20 years, a gross national well-being. It's driven by hopefulness. So when you're without a job, you have hopelessness. So, and once people fall in this hopelessness state, they not only lose the job, but they lose everything else. Their health will be challenged, their emotional state's challenged, psychology challenged. I mean, everything gets challenged by falling into this state of hopelessness. So, and he suggested that this recession is worse in this regard than any other one that we've been through in the history of the United States, because today, in the past 5-10 years, people's jobs have defined their identity in many ways, more than ever before in the history of this country. And so when you lose that job, you've lost your identity. GDP is a number in calculation, is a sum of production and consumption in a country. So in the United States, this was news to me, I didn't understand this, but in the U.S., do you know that 70% of our gross domestic product is just consumer spending? So you can see the problem when we have a recession and consumer spending drops down, why our GDP collapses. And then, of course, when GDP collapses, what also collapses with it is job creation collapses with it. And I mean, it's like a chicken-egg scenario. So we need to boost consumption and not artificially, and that's what that caused our problem. A lot of you are familiar with the credit card problems and the housing industry. We just boosted consumption by creating false ways of obtaining credit cards. People could get a credit card without zero credit. We just got people just so convinced they could build their credit cards up to $40,000-$60,000. I mean, people are carrying, I think the average American was at $23,000 in credit card debt, which is unbelievable. But that's where we were as a society. And because we were creating consumption to boost the economy. Well, the problem is it's false consumption because it's consuming with other people's money, right? So it's not true consumption at all. And eventually the house of cards collapsed. The idea of GDP, though, that's going to be the world leader. And if you look at GDP, where are we? Well, obviously, the United States is at the top. I attached charts for you at the back of your outline so you can review those. And you can see that number two to the United States is right behind us is China. And, of course, that's why they talk about China taking over the world in terms of being the economic power because it is so huge and it's growing at a rapid pace, whereas number three and four, Japan and Germany, are not growing very much at all. So they're more in the recessionary states that we're in. So we see China is the one that's taking precedence here. But it's interesting to look at the GDP of the top 25 countries in the world to give you some flavor of where the people are in terms of in comparison to the United States. When China eventually crosses over our GDP, they will again, we will lose the reign as economic leader of the world, and the repercussions of that will be widespread. We don't know exactly what they'll be because we don't know. We can't predict total human behavior, but we know it'll be widespread because people will no longer be looking to the United States when making decisions. They'll be looking to China, and so China will be playing a more demonstrative role in all of the things that happen around the world. The only solution is for us to expand our GDP and through this experience, of course, increase job growth. And we need to do that, and that's why a lot of the policies and plans that we see happening, like reducing money to consumers, higher taxes, all these kind of things, it reduces spending, which reduces GDP. And when all this happens, of course, entitlements must fall, and we're seeing the pressure on that as well right now with regard to, you know, just Social Security alone. It takes three workers paying into Social Security to pay cover one worker who's retired and collecting Social Security. And we know what the baby boomers going on. That's going to even put more of a crisis on our backs if our job market doesn't expand. And a lot of people have a misconception about who's creating jobs in our world. The small and medium-sized companies are responsible for most of the jobs in America. In 2007, there were 6 million companies in America, and 99% of which had 500 or fewer employees. So it's the smaller companies that are creating the jobs that make up our job market, not the monster companies. In fact, in his book, he discloses how the big companies actually reduce jobs, and they do it in many ways. They outsource, they condense, they buy each other, they merge and shut down because they have efficient economies of scale by merging and cutting out one of the accounting departments, one of the payroll departments, one of the, you know, human resource departments, all the things. They end up being more consolidator of jobs than creator of jobs. He did a review on China and looked at China's GDP that's going to grow much faster than the U.S., and people argue about BRIC, you know, the BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. Well, the reason why India and Russia don't play a role in this is if you look on the chart, you're going to see that India and Russia are so far behind, they're not going to be the dominant world powers because they're too far behind. I mean, India is less than 10% of our GDP right now, so they have a lot further to go, whereas China's at like over one-third. They're at almost 40% of our GDP right now. So it's a big difference where China is versus where India and Russia are. And again, the same thing. He who has the gold rules, and the country with the greatest GDP has the gold, and it will have the good jobs. Detroit, he did analysis of Detroit in the book, which I thought was good as a micro example of what might happen to us on a macro basis. And we know that a few decades ago, Detroit was one of the biggest booming cities in this country. And today, it's got tumbleweeds flowing through it, and a lot of it has to do with the car industry. But nonetheless, it's an example of what can happen. When GDP falls, job growth stalls, if not going in a reversal mode, and the net impact of that. Then he also emphasized that Robert Fogel, who is the Nobel Prize for Economics, in 1993, this guy predicted that by 2040, the Chinese economy would be at 123 million, 40% of the world economy output, and U.S. would have only about 14%. So these are predictions that are being made outside the realm of just what our Gallup poll guy says. A lot of people have been looking at this for years. How do we stop this? And the interesting concept is the only way we stop it is if we repeat what happened in 1970 to 2000. And I love this historical perspective because he talked about back in the 1970s when it was predicted that Japan and Germany were going to become the superpowers and the U.S. was going to be left behind. And many of you are in my age category, I mean, and you remember those days when they talked about Japan and Germany going through all that. And why didn't that happen to us in the United States? Well, because something unpredictable by classic economic standards happened, and that's called the high-tech boom, the entrepreneurial surge, creating that massive jobs and massive demand and thus huge consumption that occurred in the 80s and 90s in the United States. We had like 25, 30 years of this incredible high-tech boom that no one could have predicted because it wasn't based on historical facts. It was based on innovation and entrepreneurism. So can we do this again? Of course we could do this again. But we need to be, that's the essence of the book, is we need to be entrepreneurial. We need to go back and to invest in innovation, in entrepreneurs, super mentors, these kind of things that drive this economy in a way that, you know, the standard just classical economics can't even conceptualize. So as he said, I put the quote in there too, the traditional classical economic formulas didn't work because the blind spot of unpredictable human entrepreneurship overwhelmed and washed out all the rest of the variables in the calculation. Well, what are we in Manatech? We're entrepreneurs, right? It's part of that entrepreneurial surge, and this again emphasizes the critical importance of us going out there and quote-unquote creating jobs, which we are when we help people create their own businesses, right? We're actually in the entrepreneur creating business, which is even above and beyond creating jobs. It's creating entrepreneurs, which create more entrepreneurs, which breed more, what, income and breed more success in the society versus people who are in a state of hopelessness. He compared classical economics with behavioral economics because that's the big distinction here. Classical economics, kind of like what I went through when I was growing up in my undergraduate degree in economics, and we learned about the limitation of resources, and back then we were told in the 1990s we'd run out of oil and we'd run out of, you know, it's amazing. I mean, all the things that were taught in classic economics, because classic economics is really utilizing historical data, recording all transactions of life and making assumptions based on pre-existing transactions that have occurred in life. And the problem with this kind of an interpretation or educational pursuit is that you're leaving out the two most powerful predictors of GDP, which are entrepreneurship and innovation. It's almost impossible to even see those, no less forecast those, but by using classical economics, you're leaving those out of the formula. So it really has no play. Classical economics has no play in what's going on in our society today. So they made a shift to looking at behavioral economic data mathematically and track what men and women were thinking before they did something, before they transacted something. And it's another quote out of the book. It said, a state of mind, a frame of mind, an attitude, or a value is always in place before a transaction takes place. So what is it that people are thinking, doing, what's their attitude before a transaction takes place? That's behavioral economic data. And he emphasized that by saying that the average American makes 20,000 to 30,000 moment-to-moment decisions each day. And these choices determine all of an American's transactions, everything that we're going to do, all of our actions, transactions, how we conduct our life. The science of behavioral economics mathematically quantifies the role human nature plays in those moments of thought. And it's intriguing today that we look at how we think and how our thoughts are challenged and our thoughts are reinforced and reviewed by the phenomenal amount of interconnectedness we have today through LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, all the things we have on the Internet where we have so much interaction with others. And so all of that, it takes part in play in how our decisions are made and all the things that happen in our lives. And I want to give you a quote out of here. It talks about classical economics can't analyze your state of mind well because it records after-the-fact transactions and outcomes. But leaders need to know those states of mind because what creates behavior is decision. And what creates decision is a state of mind or intent. And intent decides the fate of the world. I thought that was a great quote. And he talks about if you want to do a relationship with us and say, well, give an example of what this might look like. You can look back and say in December, here's a great example. In December 2010, the local police chose to confiscate the vegetable cart of a 26-year-old Tunisian man named Mohamed Bouazizi, which meant he could no longer support his family of eight. Now, this is in Tunisia. He went to the city's local headquarters to complain to officials who refused to see him. Soon after him, Bouazizi set himself on fire in protest. The people of Tunisia took up his cause, and in less than a month, they ousted Tunisia's government. One man's cause ousted Tunisia's government. A few weeks later, Egypt was in revolt against its leadership, aided in no small part by an Egyptian Google marketing executive. And Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak was thrown out. And thus, a region-wide Middle East rebellion was born. This all started when a policewoman chose to confiscate Mohamed Bouazizi's vegetable cart and hence his job. Isn't that amazing? One event, and you saw what that triggered as a just ripple effect of that. Now, there were other things going on, but that was like a start of a whole kind of revolution in the Middle East because of what happened in one decision-making process. So it's important to recognize how crucial these things are and how widespread it is and the impact that the Internet, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, all of these things have on information flow in our society. Our new secret weapon we have when you look at behavioral economics is what? Simple states of mind like confidence, optimism, determination, creativity, hope, and drive all exist before decisions that create the transactions of life. Those are the things that bring sudden GDP growth. So the fact of optimism, confidence, determination, those are the issues that get measured in behavioral economics. And that's America as a country has a phenomenal amount of strength in that ahead of a lot of other countries that we've mentioned in today's call. Because of why? Because we're a free enterprise country. When you have free enterprise and you have free-flowing decisions, you know, our First Amendment rights and everything else, we have free-flowing decisions and ideas that unleash the power of all moments of decision, even when we have tough economic times like we have today. So we have an advantage over countries that are restricted because of that free thought, freedom of thought, okay, when you're looking at behavioral economics. If you apply this to what's happening today, a lot of people I was working with, in fact, I even had this belief that, you know, our banks are just not lending money. They have money, but they're not lending money. And that's because I listened to some people out there telling me they're having some hard time borrowing money. But the problem is that banks really have a lot of money. And they, in fact, they have a ton of money on their bank. They can borrow money at 0% interest rate, so they have almost an endless stream of money available to them. But the reason businesses aren't borrowing isn't because they are not, they're getting no's from banks. It's because they don't have the spirit to grow. In other words, they're lacking confidence, not lacking credit. And the Gallup poll research showed that human decisions are 70% emotional and 30% rational, meaning they need to feel that conditions are right before taking action. And that's what's stifling a big part of our economy today. Small businesses aren't growing because they're insecure about the future. They have lack of confidence, so they're not taking steps to step out in any kind of risk format, which is what small business is all about in the first place. I'll just ask some of you when you got involved in Manatech, was that a risk for you? For me, it was a huge risk. I gave up a six-figure job. I stepped out in total faith that this was going to be the direction, or this was the direction the Lord had me choose and directed me, and it was a huge risk. So risk is what creates reward. The higher the risk, the higher reward, right? And that's what we need to take. But people are just, you know, they're crawling back in their shell in this time because that's behavioral economics, and we need to start breaking out of that in terms of making a direction. The Gallup poll international data showed U.S. needs to have 5% GDP annual growth to maintain its leadership, and we saw the last month, I think there was a 2.5% growth, and the stock market went crazy because it was unexpected, which is good news to see some growth. It meant people were spending, but it didn't mean people were earning because our jobless numbers are still bad. So if people are spending and they're not earning, that means they're not saving or they're taking out of saving, which isn't a good factor either. But it does increase our GDP in our economy. He said individuals are the global economy, and I wanted to read you a quote in the book from that. And the quote goes, individuals are global economy. Every individual is a source of jobs, energy in some way. Every individual is an economic engine. All the decisions people make every day are the economy. All the decisions and choices, yours and mine and everyone else's, are the economy. An economy rises and falls on people's combined consciousness. America's economic future isn't huge and vague. It starts with every individual. It's connected. It's changeable. That quote to me is very, very empowering. It just talks about we, the people. It is up to each one of us. It's not about looking somewhere outside. It's about looking within. We are the economy. So what are we doing about the economy? If we're sitting back and waiting and watching, then we're a detriment to this economy. We need to be interactive. We need to be actively pursuing. We need to be stepping out in faith. And we are the economy. So that was awesome. It just gave a great direction there. Cities. He talked about cities because he really believes, Clifton believes that our revitalization needs to come at a local level. It's not going to come at the federal level because the federal government was never meant to be the job creator, right? I mean, that's ridiculous. That's not what the federal government was set up to do. I mean, can they put stimulus packages out to help stimulate something? Yeah, but they're not. There's no longevity in federal jobs. In fact, we're going to lose more federal jobs in the next 4 to 10 years than we've ever created. I mean, it's going to happen because it has to happen. We have to become more streamlined. But the intriguing part is that we can use a little stimulus, perhaps, but it's not the federal government. That's not their arena, and they don't create permanent jobs. They would just temporarily do that something. So we have to look at our local. We have to stay local. That means you and me, people. It gets back to us as individuals. But it also gets back to the cities and looking at powerful leaders within your city, not necessarily the politicians, but the powerful leaders. They call them tribal leaders in this book. They're local people, highly respected, successful people. They're not typically not politicians. But the plan is that we focus on local, pulling off, doubling the entrepreneurial energy by aligning local forces. Well, we're the entrepreneurs, people. We need to double our, you know, all of us need to double our entrepreneurial energy. We need to go out there and find others and grow our entrepreneurial businesses because we're in the business of growing entrepreneurs. That's what network marketing is. It's a business of growing entrepreneurs. And he developed a plan, he said, in here he had focused on four things for the cities and local environments to do, which would be us. We can look at ourselves as our own city. Recognize most important solutions are local. Have the entire city wage a war for jobs. Align efforts citywide. And don't allow city constituencies to look toward Washington. In other words, really focus on doing it yourself. And that's the direction we all need to go. If we do this, it'll be incredible what we can create. And that's where the job creation, the economic market needs to be growing. He talked about super mentors, and we're really the super mentors. I like to hear, I'll give you this, the heroes America need for this moment in history will come from those who guide, advise, encourage, and mentor a small business to success, which is the conception moment that saves a city and a country. That is us, the heroes America needs for this moment in history. Are people like you and me who guide, advise, encourage, and mentor a small business to success. Those are the people, our team members. And that's truly what's going to save a city and a country. So that we call ourselves, I call ourselves super mentors. We're both the entrepreneurs as well as the creators of confidence and action with other entrepreneurs. So we're entrepreneurs creating entrepreneurs. These people are critical. The best example he gave was Al Gore. He is the one who took the founder of the Internet, Vinton Cerf, and convinced him to commercialize it. In other words, Vinton Cerf created the Internet for only one purpose, and that was for a defense budget as part of a defense project for our federal government. And it was Al Gore who sat down with him one day and discussed what he had done and what he was doing and all this stuff. And out of Al Gore's mouth became, why don't you take this and commercialize it? And the guy said, I never thought about that. And he says, my gosh, think of the business ramifications if you could commercialize this. Well, that was the beginning of the Internet that you and I, as we know it today. It really came out of Vinton Cerf's discovery, but Al Gore was the instrumental guy that triggered it to commercialize. And, of course, it created, saved millions of jobs and created millions of jobs over the next 25 years. The other aspect of this, he talked about universities, you know, there's certain areas where you can find an ecosystem where entrepreneurship and innovation is driven, and of course, universities are part of that as well. And he said whether the U.S. stays a world leader or even solvent will be determined primarily upon three kinds of people, entrepreneurs, inventors, and super mentors. And we are two of those. Inventors, Manatech. We're the entrepreneurs and the super mentors. So we have play a huge role in the success of this country. Entrepreneurship versus innovation. And a lot of you have heard this before. Calvin Coolidge, the first quote I really love is, nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. This is so critical for all of us on this call. Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education alone will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent. And that's by Calvin Coolidge. So if you want to take that quote off there and put that, slap that on your wall somewhere, that's a great one to keep reminding yourself. Because whenever you get low and, you know, I look at myself sometimes in Manatech, I don't want to do something or I get, you know, I come up against my stuff. You know, we all got stuff, right? You got that little voice, or you got things that happen in your life and you just, you know, for me it's readily easy to dismiss it because I know it's there and I know it can arise and it has more to do with what I'm going through in my current day versus the need for me to be totally proactive and help contribute to the growth of the United States and help people in a mode other than staying in just their bare survival mode. So when I start putting other, that's why it works so well to get out of this. You know, when you get out of, to get out of your stuff is just focus on other people. And that's the number one trigger to get you out of your stuff because it's, you're focusing on yourself when you get that stuff coming up. But we all need that. But the concept of persistence and determination, that's the bottom line. It's about just pursuing right through it, busting through it, and not letting things, roadblocks, get in your way. And I talk to people some days in Manatech, and, you know, they lose entire days. Some people lose entire weeks over stuff. And time is your most incredibly valuable asset because it's your only limited asset. And so when you start giving it away to something outside, you give it away to a triggering event in your life, start evaluating, what is that really about? What is that really about? Why am I giving it away? And start saying, am I so unimportant? Is it so unimportant what I'm trying to achieve with what I'm doing with Manatech in my own life? Is saving children worldwide so unimportant that I'm giving away? I'm allowing someone else to control my time, my only limited asset. So grapple with that and use that and dig into yourself and see your, you know, that's something that a lot of us need to do every day. And it's hard sometimes to coach that as well because people have a lot of excuses why they give away a week or a month or a 2 days, you know, and you don't want to be tough on them. But the reality is they need that lesson at some point in their life because we're very capable of compartmentalizing if we choose to. If something happens in our life that takes us away and takes a, you know, something serious happens, we need to learn to compartmentalize that issue so that we can move on in the rest of our areas of lives. We can always go back to it, but we've set it aside so it doesn't control our lives. Don't give control your life away. So innovation and creativity are, neither innovation or creativity are rare in the United States. Let's talk about, because he's talking about entrepreneurship versus innovation. What's wrong is a mass shortage of successful business models. The scarcest, rarest, hardest energy and talent in the world to find is entrepreneurship. Wow, that's you and me, people, right? So now if he's saying it's the scarcest, rarest, hardest energy and talent in the world to find, does that mean that maybe you shouldn't get discouraged if you go out there and you talk to 10 people and you can't get a positive response, people want to join you in your business and as be an entrepreneur? Well, maybe not, but you know what? You just use that famous word, N-E-X-T, right? And as Hardy says on his switch, his Make the Switch video, or CD, Make the Switch from what? Yeah, employee to entrepreneur. What does he tell you to do? He tells you to go out and get 20 no's. He knows what's out there. He says, go out and get them, right? Because it's a model that isn't going to be attractive to everybody and anybody, and some people are going to have to convince of the value of it. But it's an incredibly critical model, right? And it's what we have in Manatech. The precious connector between innovator and customer is the almighty entrepreneur. That's you and me. The person who envisions the value in a customer and then creates a business model and strategy that creates sales and profits. And Manatech's given us an incredible, between network marketing as a model, which is awesome, right? And remember what you have from the Wall Street Journal is one of the most incredible social models of business out there today, respected as that. But in addition to that, we have this incredible plan that Manatech has helped put together, an 18-month plan that just makes it that much easier for us to describe it, discuss it, show the benefits of it, and work with people. He brought up intrapreneurs, which are people who create customers, and we do that as well in Manatech. We're both entrepreneurs and intrapreneurs. We go out and create customers. How do we do that? Well, we get knowledgeable about glyconutrients and real food technology, and we share it with people who get started on the program. So we help others. It's by helping others. I love the statement he made, human development occurs when there is resistance. Manatech, anyone? Do any of you feel any resistance when you start doing Manatech? And does stuff come up in your life that you want to back away from? How about the fear, the cold calling, all the things? Man, there's resistance everywhere, right? You don't want to call back a person. You're afraid maybe they're not going to want to sign up. You don't want to call back a friend of yours because he's having some reaction to one of the products. You don't want to, and it's ridiculous what we get stuck in, all this resistance we go through. Throw it out the window. Every single opportunity, here's how I get over it, so you can choose this as well. But I look at it this way. Every single opportunity I get to interact with somebody is a joy in my life because it gives me one more opportunity to impact their life in some way, shape, or form. Now, you can say, well, Mary Jo, what if she's screaming and yelling? And you know what? Then I have an opportunity to maybe help calm her down. Because where she is doesn't impact me. It doesn't control. I don't let her or this other person control my life. I just get to be in her life. And if I can be in somebody's life and support them in some way, shape, or form, that's what I'm here to do, is to serve. So that's the joy of when somebody calls, whether it's good news, bad news, whatever it might is, I want to be on it in a rocket shot. Same thing. We can take that same thing. Sorry, I'm getting off a little path, but I think a lot of this is great Manatech stuff as well, so you can take this and apply it to your Manatech business. Entrepreneurship does not just supply, it builds demand. True entrepreneurs either take a current product or service and make it available to those who are not served or underserved, or they take a new idea and build enthusiasm, interest, and desire for it, a new demand. I think we do both. I think we take a product or service and make it available to those. I think we're making a product available to people. I also think we're taking apart a whole new idea, a new concept out there, this real switch concept, this concept of real food technology is huge in people's lives. There is so much junk out there in the nutritional industry, and we need to help support people to get off their petroleum-laced products and onto something that's great. By the way, I used that on the boat the other day. I was talking to somebody. I was just having a joyful conversation, and they asked about how many cruises we've been on. I said, oh, my gosh, so many. I never have ever paid for one yet. And they looked at me. Isn't that a great statement? I've never paid for one yet. And they're like, how are you doing that? I said, I win all these trips. It's amazing. I said, I am in the nutrition field, and I absolutely love this company's products, so I use it frequently in giving people advice and helping people, you know, get better and get off drugs and all sorts. It's just a joy. And I said, through that process, I win these trips. They have incentives from time to time, and I win the trips. And so right away we're back into nutrition, you know, and they go, really? So what? And then they start asking questions. Remember, you intrigue people. It was a joy. And by the time I was done, I exchanged a card with them, but I said, this is what I want you to do. I just want you to go. Do you take a vitamin mineral? And they said, yeah, we take one right now. I said, great. Go home when you get off this cruise. Go home. Put it in the oven. Bake it for 15 minutes at 350 degrees. And then give me a call. And I give them my card. Isn't that great? Ah! So just joy. Joy, joy, joy. A way to serve. We have a new technology. Sorry I interjected that, but just another concept for you guys if you're out there trying to figure out what to say to people. Entrepreneurs are people of action and possess an unnatural overload of two characteristics. What are our two characteristics? Optimism and determination. In other words, there's that persistence again, the Calvin Coolidge thing. But optimism. We never see barriers. Nothing ever gets in our way. Something comes up, we go, okay, how do we solve it? Move on. Next, we go through it. And we never quit. We're persistent and determined. We never quit. And you can see that in Manatech by seeing all the people that were on that boat. These people were not quitters. These people were out there fighting. Entrepreneurs are rare doers, and because of this, they are the most valuable people in the world, at least as far as the pursuit of economic development, GDP growth, and almighty job creation are concerned. That's a great quote, and that's what you're trying to find as entrepreneurs. And you can use all of this information, people, in your business, because when you're looking out there, you say, you know what, here's what an entrepreneur is. Did you read this book? Let me give you some quotes from this book. Look at this. It's because of this, they're the most valuable people in the world, at least as far as pursuit of economic development, GDP growth, and almighty job creation are concerned. Do you see yourself fitting in that realm? Do you want to make a difference? You know, I mean, it's fun. You just have joy with, you know, and I'm going to put a sheet together, I told Lydia, of just a lot of the quotes and material out of here so that I'm going to pass it on to all of you so that you can, I'll put the book name and everything like that. You don't have to go read it yourself, but you can use some of those quotes because I think a quote sheet just from this book on how to use some of this material in terms of prospecting and talking to people is marvelous. There's so much great data in here, and you can pick and choose what you want, or you can just use the entire sheet. But they also had a quote. Let me give you this quote because I thought of Sam when I was reading this in the book. He said this. This is what to look for in an entrepreneur, somebody with an idea that totally consumes him, an idea that becomes the way he thinks, a way of life, and an obsession. That obsession fuels unstoppable optimism and determination. Hang on a second, people. Lydia, I can't do it. Please. Sorry, I'm trying to get rid of that racket in the background here. Does this not sound like Sam? I mean, it just sounded like Sam to me. That obsession fuels unstoppable optimism and determination. That is Sam Castor, so ultimate in entrepreneur. The next area was high-energy work environments. He talked about the importance, and a lot of this had to do with job environments, but I think you can apply it to what we're doing in Manatech, because we don't have a job environment, but we have teams, right? We have Manatech team members, and we can see people that are, you know, and his Gallup poll determined that 28% of American workforce is engaged, another 53% is not engaged, and a staggering 19% is actively disengaged. And when he talks about the definition of that, engaged workforce means people that are really trying to better their environment. They're making, you know, their employees that are constantly contributing to their environment. How do I improve my environment? They're excited about their job. They like what they're doing, right? Disengaged, not engaged, the 53% not engaged are people that just go to work, punch in, take their thing, and punch out. So they're not engaged. They work because why? Because they're making a living. But it's about sitting down, drinking a cup of coffee. It's not about bettering themselves or bettering the work environment or doing anything else. They're just there. They feel, this is kind of like I put people are trapped in a job and they're just there to do the job. But he said a staggering 19% are actively disengaged. These are people that are trying to booby trap their businesses. They actually go there to cause problems and detract from the job environment, which is a huge statistic. And that's why he called it a staggering statistic, right? So the bottom line is miserable employees make miserable customers, and thus they close down companies, right? And so he came up with a survey that they did. They had 12 survey items that neatly factor all workers into three categories of engaged, not engaged, and actively disengaged. And I've attached that those 12 factors in there. And I think, and what you do is you take those 12 factors, you see where do you apply on a scale of 1 to 5. And I think you can do this with some of your Manatech team members, just see where people are. So at least you get a feedback of what people are doing and where they're stuck and not stuck. I think it's a great tool to use in your leadership in your Manatech business. Because if you don't know why somebody's held back or what they're thinking, how do you best coach them into taking a better approach, right? You might have a team member that's just off there somewhere, and you're going, well, I don't know what's wrong, what's going on, they're discouraged or this, and you like to jump to conclusions, but you really don't know what's really happening for the person. So maybe give them this 12-point sheet and say, on a scale of 1 to 5, it talks about work environment, but all you have to do is change that to Manatech, right? And so add that into Manatech business and change the language a little bit, and you would have some great results. And mind you, the questions that are in their statements that are in these surveys that I'm giving you, these things were developed by the Gallup company's scientists. I mean, these were extensively researched, and I mean, somebody just did slap them on a sheet of paper, so there's a tremendous amount of money and time and energy and intelligence that went behind formulating these. So I would suggest that you have a tool now. You apply this to your team members to give you an idea where they are. What leadership activity or behavioral economic variable best predicts real sales increase? This is one of the things that he asked that question in the book. And he said, undoubtedly, it's customer engagement. So first of all, we talked about employee engagement, or for us in Manatech, our team engagement. But what about customer engagement? What are you doing today around your customer? If you as a Manatech Manatech entrepreneur, don't have a customer service program, you're missing the boat. And that's why your business grows and shrinks and grows and then shrinks. And it's based totally on whether you're active or not. Why are there people out there that still have, you know, a major percentage of their business, no matter what we went through in the last 5 years? Because we have a valid customer service program. We do manna mails. We make phone calls. We do Christmas cards. We do Thanksgiving things. We do special things that make a difference in people's lives so they know we care. So what are you doing to make sure that people know you care? Well, one thing Manatech's adopting is a new program, and it'll probably kick off the first of the year, but I will love this. And this is something that's great. They're going to come out with like that, remember Healthy Living magazine? But they're going to build one strictly for consumers. And if you commit, and I don't remember what the price, you as a leader can choose to have Manatech send it out to everybody, every consumer in your organization. I think it only applies to presidential so that you are less than presidential. I don't know how you participate if your upline presidential doesn't, but I'm not sure how this all goes. But they'll come out with some formula for it so you can figure it out. But they're going to send out every other month, your consumers are going to get one of these health and living kind of magazines. But it's going to be personalized with you. Isn't that cool? I just think it's a neat thing. It's going to be a way to stay on top of your customers. So those of you who don't want to put the energy behind making manna mails once a month or the things that I do, you have other ways of doing that. Manatech's going to support that, which I think is awesome. The next chapter was all about customer science. Again, you just have to, you know, we can't compete, just like we can't really compete on price. People can find cheaper stuff out there. Of course, you get what you pay for. But we compete on knowing what our customers want and serving them. And that's very true about U.S. and their job market as well. The U.S. is more expensive. We make more expensive products than probably most places in the world. But we don't compete basically on price, but we compete, why? Because we're better listeners and we deliver what customers want. So we listen and we deliver what people want. And those are important factors in competing at the international level, for sure, even the national level. So relationships will always trump price. They inspire customer engagement. So we want to increase customer engagement. And I put a measurement, I attached the customer engagement chart as well on the end of this outline. So you can look at that and start evaluating how would your customers respond to this on a scale of 1 to 5, 5 being highest response and 1 being lowest. And your goal is to get all your customers at 5. He then went on to talk about, I'm running out of time, so that's why I'm not spending more time, because I obviously, customer service is absolutely crucial. He talked about his last couple chapters in the book, where entrepreneurs are created. He talked about what's going on in our schools today and the failure of so many things in our school system. The Bill Gates Foundation project, they did a gigantic project, put $2 billion into hiring professionals, doctorate degrees, all the things to determine why the dropout rate and how to correct the dropout rate, and it was a total, their mechanisms were a total failure. The Race to the Top was a failure, No Child Left Behind failed, all these things have failed, and so in the Gallup poll they went around and they said, well, what is causing people to drop out of school? And they found the number one reason kids drop out of school is they have no hope of what? Ever graduating. So they have to work on how do I increase the hope of graduating? So they went through all this kind of stuff, and they developed a little analysis in here, and I gave it to you. And I also, there's also a Gallup Hope Index that they did, and I don't think we attached that one, but we can get you that. But it was fascinating how they know that we have to, in order to maintain what we have in the United States, we need to do better in education. And right now our educational statistics are just awful. When you think that 30% of our kids drop out of school before finishing high school, 30%. We're not talking about small little community. We're talking 30%. I was shocked. That statistic shocked me. I don't know how many of you it shocks, but I don't have kids in high school in that today, but that's shocking. And then the second last chapter in the book was about healthcare, and I know this has touched your life in a zillion ways. This guy annihilated healthcare. I mean, he wrote this chapter for us in Manatech. He talked about healthcare costs. If healthcare costs are not addressed, nothing else will matter, since this alone will bankrupt America. It's not about insurance and who will pay. It's about prevention. He said there's absolutely no way we're ever going to solve healthcare without tackling prevention. And he said no one at the highest levels, I mean, except Michelle Obama, she's doing a heck of a job out there. I love what she's doing in regard to healthcare and in schools and getting people to eat more responsibly. She's at least highlighting it, but she's not a policymaker. She's just a national image, but, it's got to come from Congress. It's got to come from our decision makers. We've got to put more pressure. This whole healthcare, that's one of the reasons, as much as I want everybody to have health insurance in the world, so I was, in looking at trying to get health insurance for people, I just think that's part of being a Christian. That's just my opinion, okay, that I want to help people with it so that they don't die at 22 instead of having a full life. There's something about poor in that. But the idea is that all we're doing is creating more of what doesn't already function. That's the problem with it. It's that we're just promoting a system that's so broken. It's so totally broken. And he did a great analysis of it. He talked about, the two most incredible, sources that, number one, we're broken because we spend so much money on it. I can't remember what some statistic he gave. It was pretty awesome. All the statistics were all throughout that, and I wrote a bunch of stuff in here. But he said, let me see if I can give you those, because I know I loved a couple of them. Here, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that more than 75% of the total $2.5 trillion healthcare spending is on people with chronic and, in most cases, preventable conditions, such as diabetes, heart disease, and obesity. If Americans just took newfound individual responsibility for their own health, lifestyle, and well-being, the looming healthcare disaster could be miraculously fixed. Is that not an awesome quote? I know you want me to add that to the paper. It's great. That's what this is about, people. This is a Gallup poll. This isn't about somebody who's in the health industry. This is somebody that's just independent third party looking at the overall picture. I mean, why can't we as a nation draw that conclusion and do something about it? And then the researchers at Rutgers University reported that last year of life expenses. And I know this is a tough issue for some people, but I totally agree with it. The last year of life expenses constituted 22% of all medical, 26% of Medicare, 18% of all non-Medicare expenditures, and 25% of Medicaid expenditures. Is everybody getting that? So almost 25% of all our medical expenses in this country, then we're in a dire healthcare crisis that's going to shut us down, are based on what happens in people's last year of their life. So we're spending billions and billions of dollars on sustaining a person's life for 3 extra months or 6 extra months. Or five, you follow me? That's humongous. I had no clue that it represented that percentage of our total health budget. That's amazing. But we're the only country in the world, and this is what, who is the guy out of Iowa, the senator out of Iowa that was, you know, trying to revamp the health care thing and kind of was the background behind it? He's the one that said that until we're the only country in the world that spends money like that on people who are, you know, on their last days. We're the only one in the whole world. No one else comes close. And that was the big distinction, why our health care, our monthly health care costs are twice as big as the second largest in the world, the country with the second largest bill. And I believe that's still England. But ours is 50% or 100% more than what England's costs are per person in health care. But the main reason was because of this chunk that we put on that last year of life. And that's amazing. So what can we do about it? I'm just telling you people, it's a huge problem. And if we're going to let healthcare destroy this country because we think people's one last year of life is more important than the other 90 years of life that everybody else has in this country, that's a trade-off we as a nation need to start looking at and saying, how do we make that look different? So huge statistics, which are amazing. Okay, so but he talks about, you know, the behavioral changes. He talked about looking at the smoking campaign. We did an anti-smoking campaign. Did we scare kids by telling them they're going to get cancer from smoking? No. What changed children, i.e. teenagers, to stop smoking? We've seen a 50% drop in smoking of teens. And the number one way it changed was they introduced the image problem. That what kind of image do you have? And they tied this image of smoking to all sorts of negative, you know, image issues. And guess what? It totally converted the teenage smoking example. They brought up the Texas example of stopping the runaway litter costs by tapping into the pride of Texans. You see, if you drive through Texas, you know you're going to see signs everywhere with blue bonnets on it that say, don't mess with Texas. And that saved millions of dollars and saves millions of dollars on a yearly basis here in Texas of people not littering. Merely because they took the pride of Texans. There's a lot of pride in the state, if you haven't noticed, Rick Perry campaigning. A lot of pride in Texas. Anyway, they took all that pride, and they basically turned it into a profitable endeavor. Isn't that cool? Because it's about image. And so they talked about the same thing we need to do with, you know, obesity and with, you know, all these other issues, and start allocating the costs based on what people are doing. So it just was a great article, great chapter, one of my favorites of the whole book because it's our industry. And the last one of the quotes I put at the end was, there are no solutions to the healthcare problem where American leaders are currently digging. Moving the money around isn't a solution. Solutions lie within changing behavior. And we as a nation need to start promoting that. And really, one of the main ways to do that, image problem, but number two is put the cost where it belongs and make people pay for a lot of the drugs they're taking today if, in fact, they are controllable disease conditions. And his last chapter was on global well-being, and he talked about, you know, stepping up our exports and how we need to perform well in the global well-being index as well. And the most important things in global well-being, I listed them, and if we tie our exports to those things, then we're going to be able to, you know, make a difference. So that's it, people. I hope you enjoyed it. I loved the book. I think there's a lot of greatness in it, but I promise you what I'll do is I'll take out some of the quotes and I'll put a quote sheet together out of this book that might really help you in doing your business. There are a lot of great things that you can use in this book. You might even get a picture of it. I might send you that out if you guys want a picture of that as well so you can just have it. And maybe what I'll do is I took the social entrepreneur piece out of the Wall Street Journal, and I took the front cover, and on the back side I put like 8 quotes on the back side of it. Would that be something, if I did that with the Coming Jobs War book, would that be something you guys would like to have, or you tell me? Get some feedback from all of you.
Probably. I think that would be very helpful, Mary Jo.
Rudy, thanks. Okay, buddy. All right. I'll make one for you.
Mary Jo?
Yeah.
I read an article in the paper, and this is itself going to be a big crisis. They're saying that the gray generation, like me, they're retiring, and there's not going to be enough people to fill their shoes as far as jobs. And so that's going to put our GNC down. And, of course, also the job market and saving for Social Security, the 3 they have to save for the 1.
Yep, 3 people for every 1. 3 to 1, and we don't have that currently existing in our society.
No, we're running out of people to fill in the jobs of these massive amounts of people that are going to retire.
Well, and think about all the plans that you hear out there from the politicians, how they want to have separate savings accounts now for the younger employees. Well, my gosh, that takes all of them out of supporting the ones that are retiring, right? And you have none because they're not contributing anymore to Social Security. They're going to have their own independent savings accounts. So you got we got a lot of issues, don't we? Yeah. We got a lot of issues. Yep.
All right, Jo, this is Mary. To answer your question, it would be wonderfully helpful to have the cover and a half dozen quotes, 6 to 8 quotes on the back. That'd be super.
Right. Absolutely. I'll
Thank
be more
so
than happy
much.
To
Thank you so much. That'd be wonderful.
Yeah, you bet.
I wanted to say ditto on that. I just had my hands in the dishwasher. to answer you, but yes,
all
please.
Right.
Thanks, Mary Jo.
Thanks. Absolutely. Will do. All right, everybody. Anyone else? Any last-minute comments?
Mary Jo, thanks for that.
It would be great to have the Wall Street Journal one as well.
I don't think you guys have it on my Monday call. I made it for my my boot camp, but I'll be more than happy to say, because I think Ray Robbins took it and he's taken it around to all of his meetings. So I'll send that out to you guys. So you can, all you got to do is get it laminated. I'll send it to you and you just can laminate it, okay? So you'll get it by email, and my suggestion is you take it down and get it laminated front and back in color, and what a blessing. The Wall Street Journal one is terrific from a perspective if someone ever complains about, is this network marketing? And you go, is it network marketing? Absolutely. And he says, are you familiar with the Wall Street Journal? And they'll go, well, yeah. And you go, do you know they did an entire 44-page expose on network marketing saying it's the number one social model for business today? And they'll look at you like, what? I mean, they'll be shocked. And then you can pull this laminated sheet out and turn it over and read some of the quotes that I put on. I mean, it's amazing. It's really amazing. But great. I'll do that. I'll send you that one as well. Great tools for prospecting. And
you,
we
Mary.
Need them.
For
you bet.
Excellent book review. And it starts with number 1. That's me.
Yeah, you got it. If you didn't get that from the book, you got it. Hopefully I got that emphasis out there. We as individuals are the economy, right? Right. Amen. Yep. All right, everybody. Great. Yeah, it was easy to do a great book review because what a great book. I was really excited about it. And again, some of you may not enjoy it as much as I did, but with my econ poli sci background, this just like it hit a home run ball in my life. So I was very excited about the material and excited how it applied so directly to what we're all about. So, all right, everybody. Love you all. Everybody. Yeah, Fred.
Yeah. Quick question. When you see Mr. Duncan, ask him if we can't get a video explaining the Built for Speed program, especially emphasizing how important the iPad is going to be to help us, and also the MAP program. Get that in that video about how that can impact our success of this whole Built for Speed program.
From a educational perspective for associates, or you're talking about for associates, not prospecting?
No, if we had this little video, then we could email the video out to prospects that we're working for, working with in other states. In other words, it's a way that we can explain the Build for Speed program through a video from Manatech, and I think we should highlight the importance of the iPad, how it will contribute on creating a speed in that program, and also the MAP program. We're actually going to be coaching people. This is different for us. We've never done that before, but this is very important to that program.
So you want Manatech to create a tool,
right, in a video,
in video format that would cover how the Build for Speed, what that sheet actually says, in addition
right.
to the importance of the iPad as well as MAP. You want
right.
it all in one?
In a video that we can send out through the internet, you know, we can forward the video to people.
Coaching, and this would be for prospecting.
Right.
For prospects, so they can see how easy the business is, kind of?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
Yeah, we're competing with all these other companies about our comp plan with their comp plan, but this has got a lot of magnitude, and of course include that, you know, how many kids are impacted. So this our compensation, our Build for Speed program has also purpose to it.
Yeah. So, okay. I'm trying to think of how best to do that. So it's more of, rather than, so it stays away from the products, it just talks about why the Manatech business kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Why choose Manatech as business?
Yeah, I mean, you could have, a little blurb about Phytomatrix and Ambertoast, you know, two little blurbs maybe. But the emphasis, I think, is we need to educate people of what we truly have now on this new Build for Speed program. This is awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I'm just thinking through in my head. Let me think through that, Fred. So I want to be able to clarify it with Brett before I present
right.
it to him. Okay, and if I might call you back on it if I have some questions. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Great. It might be something that Brett looks at me and says, "Mary Jo, why don't you build it?" I can almost bank on that response right now, so I have to try to phrase it a little differently so I can pass the buck. Okay. All right, everybody. Love you all. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Bye.